Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Yusuf Ibrahim. I'm very honored to chair this session. I know it was a very light lunch, and you're going to pay a lot of attention to our distinguished speakers. As a chairman, I'd like to be like, I will play the role of the government pre the financial crisis. And I will use the time to hear words of wisdom from our speakers. But I just want to mention a few points. The first is amazing how media is affecting our lifestyle and our thinking. 6 months ago, we were talking about sovereign wealth funds as the dragon that is attacking the world. And now we are talking about the sovereign wealth fund, a tool to help in rescuing the world financial system. And through the media, we have, as they say, the flavor of the month. One day we talk about the collapse of Dubai. The second day we talk about the collapse of the financial institutions. And I don't know what we're going to talk about next month. So I believe with a great school like London School of Economics, we can use history and we use knowledge and economic theory to analyze the current situation we are in, and to use our, as we say in Arabic, our brain, not our emotions, to tackle the financial crisis that the whole world is facing nowadays. We have three distinguished speakers, and we will start with Professor Danny Cole, who is going to talk about challenges and opportunities facing the global economy. And this is a macroeconomic perspective, and I think this is the best way to start our session. Danny.
Thank you. It is indeed a great pleasure to be here. My topic, as you've heard described, will be challenges and opportunities facing the global economy. Given the state of the global economy, you might think that the real challenge is to find any opportunities at all in it. My goal here this afternoon is also to set the stage, as it were, for my colleagues who will follow in this session, who will delve a little bit more deeply into the global economy. Now, at this point, you have already been warned I am an economist, and I'm going to be talking about the global economy. And you're probably silently groaning in your seat because you think, rightly, that you've already heard a bunch of economists talk earlier this morning about the global economy, about globalization, and about the current global economic crisis. You had three presentations here from an economic perspective, and you ended up with six different viewpoints and opinions on what the true state of the world economy is. And you're thinking, oh no, yet another one. And why can't these economists just settle once and for all what the facts are or what their views are, and then just tell us, give us a range of options on how to proceed? What I want to do, in a way that I think distinguishes a little bit from the earlier presentations, is talk about some of the same challenges that face the global economy, but look at some facts or bring to light some facts that tend to take us in a way that disagrees or diverges somewhat from the presentations earlier. So what is the nature of the divergence? Well, I will agree with some of the earlier presentations this morning and talk about the great challenges that face us stemming from two large factors. The first of these I'm going to call extreme finance, I will take us through a little bit of the discussion on that and then relate that to something that might have been thrown out a little bit dismissively earlier this morning. I want to bring to light some facts on the large global imbalances that go hand in hand with extreme finance for, in my view, bringing us to the current state of the global economy. But that large global imbalance is not something that sprung spontaneously in a way that, you know, as these things sometimes do, to confound global economic progress. I want to argue that this has come out of a natural process that is the shifting distribution of world economic activity. And to cut to the chase here, is a distribution shifting world economic activity eastwards. I will then turn to what the opportunities are, and here I think there are three. The first of these, somewhat paradoxically, comes out of the same set of factors that has led to why we are in the state of the world that we are in, the shifting distribution of world economic activity. I think it is by understanding that we will understand how the Gulf and the rest of the world economy can look forwards to opportunity. Okay. Turn to the first of these factors, extreme finance. What I think about as extreme finance is the state of the world where through most of the last two decades, we've seen global interest rates fall hand in hand with the availability of cheap credit. I want to argue how that has led to a buildup of so-called structured finance and then the unwinding and deleveraging out of that is why the world now sits facing possibly the largest global economic downturn in the last 70 years. Low interest rates and cheap credit is a characterization, a description of the world. But why that should have led to the building up of trillion-dollar financial infrastructure in the way that it ended up doing, and why the unwinding and deleveraging happened the way it did, is not, when you think about it for a second, immediately obvious. Low interest rates and cheap credit could have resulted in a global explosion of investment in public health services. With cheap credit, resources are available, you can actually improve the economy around you. There could have been, in the United States, an expansion and investment in internet infrastructure. More resources from cheap credit and low interest rates could have been put into education and research and development, into building roads and railways and other transportation infrastructure. For most of recorded history, the availability of credit has led to improvements in productivity of this kind. But what we saw happen in the 1990s, in the last two decades, was something quite different. This is the development of so-called structured finance. Now, on the surface, structured finance is a good thing, because what it sets out to do is to help transfer risk across people in an economy, taking risk from those who are unwilling to bear it and placing it in the hands of those who are willing to do so at a price. How structured finance sought to do this was by repackaging financial assets and diverting payment streams across different investor groups. At the same time that it did that, however, structured finance, to streamline the process, altered credit ratings favorably on probably financial assets that should not have had that happen to them. The complexity of many of these securitized products, together with other factors, led to lowered underwriting standards that failed to properly account for the underlying risk. Okay. This built up a trillion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar financial infrastructure built on structured financial products that in turn built on yet other risky financial products. The unwinding and the deleveraging of that infrastructure has led to a collapse of confidence and trust. It's clogged credit channels and it's ended up and it's brought the world to a point where goods and services that are usefully valued by consumers are not actually produced. Now, the root of all this discussion, which is relatively uncontroversial, I've simply filled in some details, is cheap credit. How did the world come to have this flood of cheap credit? And that question achieves special resonance because the largest economy in the world through the previous two decades was not saving hugely to provide financial resources to the world. The graph that I've plotted for you shows in the blue line the explosion of the U.S. trade deficit. From a period from 1980s to the 1990s, early 1990s, of roughly trade balance, but subsequently to an explosion of the U.S. trade deficit to, by 2006, in excess of $900 billion. $900 billion is about 7-8% of U.S. GDP. It might not seem that much, but on this graph I have also put for you the GDP of India. India is a billion people economy. The red line shows that by the early 2000s, the U.S. trade deficit had overtaken Indian GDP. And the U.S. trade deficit took on the singular honor of falling below Indian GDP because India, thankfully, grew faster in the mid-2000s than previously had been expected. Okay. This is not the reason why cheap credit flooded the world. For many people, the reason cheap credit flooded the world comes from breaking down the U.S. trade balance, which I've drawn here, flipping the sign so that you can see exactly what happened. The U.S. economy moved into deficit sharply from 1990 on, so that by the middle of 2006, I could tell my American friends they were consuming one India more than their neighbors were producing. Who was financing this splurge of consumption? Well, as previously mentioned by other speakers, some East Asian economies. So this picture shows you the U.S.-China bilateral trade balance. The bilateral trade balance, of course, is just the flip side of the capital account. And when the U.S. bilateral trade balance moves into deficit against China, what that's telling us is that China was exporting capital to the United States. And there, in the eyes of many, is the source for the cheap credit, the low interest rates that led to the development of structured finance and the subsequent deleveraging. So far, this is the telling of the conventional story of the current global economic crisis. But here's where I want to throw a spanner in the works and then take us in the direction of how the current situation leads to opportunity rather than simply crisis. I have added now to the previous chart the U.S. bilateral trade balance, not just against China, but now in the red line against the oil exporting countries, so a significant chunk of which would be the Gulf, and the European Union in the green line. And here you see that the U.S. economy was importing capital, not just from China and East Asian friends, but also from the Gulf, and from, of all places, the European Union. When you add the bilateral trade deficits on oil exporters and the European Union together, what you get is a bilateral trade deficit profile for the EU and the oil exporting countries that matches almost dollar for dollar, step by step, the U.S. bilateral trade deficit against China. Pause and think about what this does. The simple story that cheap credit and low interest rates was due to an East Asian or Chinese savings glut does not seem as convincing when now you see that the global savings glut appeared as much in the oil exporting countries and in the European Union. It's then much more of a mouthful to say oil exporters, EU and Asia savings glut. And it's therefore not as compelling an explanation for why we have had two decades of cheap credit and low interest rates. But where does this take us? How does unpacking this global savings glut to a point where we no longer believe the hypothesis, where we no longer think that it's the global savings glut that's led the world economy to be the state that it's in. Where does it take us? Part of what's going on here is a rise in economic power in the East and in among the oil exporting countries, and in the EU relative to the United States. And this shift in economic activity, in trade, production, consumption, and savings, is simply a passive reflection of that shifting distribution of global economic activity, rather than a single explanation in terms of a savings glut. And if we recognize that it was indeed a shift in the distribution of global economic activity, what does that tell us about the opportunities to come up? Well, first, reality check. Was it all a bad thing that we had this shift in global economic activity? Well, one quick thing to say is that actually this shift in economic activity eastwards did a lot of good for the world. So let's step back from simply trying to rationalize or explain the U.S. economy, but think about what the world actually did. Now, this table, which contains far too many details, but what I want you to do is cast your eye on the third row of this table. It shows you the number of world's poor measured in millions over the last two decades. It shows that in 1981, there were close to 2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day in the world. And by 2005, casting your eye rightwards, that number had fallen to 1,400 million. There was a 500 million, half a billion reduction in world poverty over the same time that the East grew, sent capital, and ran bilateral trade surpluses against the United States. But, and we realize that it is exactly that the East grew, because when you look at the number of China's poor over the same time period, China reduced its a dollar a day poverty from 835 million in 1981 to 208 million in 2005, a reduction that's almost exactly the same number as the total world reduction in global poverty. These last two decades, which saw the buildup of the largest global imbalances ever, which might be leading now to the world's largest deleveraging exercise and the world's greatest economic recession for the last 70 years, in the course of that time, it actually ended up doing a lot of good in the world. Okay. Question is whether that will continue, what prospects like that, what this understanding gives us in terms of prospects looking forwards. The East ended up not just removing almost all of, you know, successfully reducing the world's poverty single-handedly, it also successfully stabilized previous economic downturns. So if we step away from thinking about growth and poverty and these large-scale trend movements, think about the last two times the U.S. economy went into recession. That was 10 years apart, first in 1991 and then in 2001. In 1991, the United States economy actually saw a reduction in GDP. East Asia, in that year, grew by 20 times what the U.S. reduction in GDP turned out to be. China grew by three times what the reduction in U.S. GDP turned out to be. If in 1991 the world economy did not collapse because the U.S. economy went into a tailspin, it's because these enduring shifts in the global distribution of economic activity carried forwards the world economy. These are numbers measured at market exchange rates. They're what we used to think of as good Yankee dollars, not funny purchasing power parity. Same thing happened in 2001. If this pattern continues, if history is a guide, then East Asia and China, contrary to what Will Hutton believes, East Asia and China gives us the best chance for the world economy moving forwards from here. Okay, what does that leave us in terms of a resource-rich, globalized part of the world like the Gulf? There is no question that China and the rest of East Asia have had a tough year. Okay, in China alone saw freezing ice storms in February last year. It saw the massive Sichuan earthquake in May. It had its Beijing economy paralyzed by the Olympics in August. There's every reason to think that the Chinese economy would have weakened from all of these. But at the same time, there are bright spots. And here, the facts seem to be not so well known. So let me tell you some of these that give me some conviction that this hypothesis that the shifting distribution of world economic activity eastwards holds promise even through the current economic dire circumstances. Last year, pretty much the only bank that showed profits was Standard Chartered. Profits were up 17%, and the reason is Standard Chartered does almost no business in the US and the UK. Bank profits were up 17% last year. Asia accounted for more than 85% of pre-tax profit for Standard Chartered. The Shanghai stock market has risen almost constantly since the November announcement of the 4 trillion renminbi fiscal stimulus plan in China. Chinese purchasing managers' confidence levels have been constantly up since the same time. Total bank loans in China rose 19% in 2008, up from a year ago. Pretty much the only country in the world, the only large banking system in the world that has seen an increase in loan activity. New cell phone subscriptions in India reached a record high of 11 million in January 2009, mostly from rural customers who continue to demand the goods and services that allow them to survive in this economy and who, believe it or not, were not heavily invested in subprime mortgages nor in securitized CDOs. The Malaysian banking system reports that its banking capital was only 0.3% exposed to U.S. subprime mortgage market. Okay. So there are seeds of good news in the midst of all these dire circumstances, and the good news all point in the direction that history, a history that looks at the facts, seem to tell us. As Chinese and Indian consumers continue to grow richer, their consumption of meat and milk will grow at least as fast as incomes. Commodity prices will stand to rise. Through all of East Asia, production is highly energy intensive. For every dollar of GDP that Asia generally, or East Asia in particular, produces, it takes three times the amount of energy that the United States and Western Europe use. Growth in East Asia, in particular, growth that continues to sustain the world economy, is good news for a part of the world where energy is important. Let me conclude. What I've done is I've told you about the challenges that face the world economy. I've told you about how pretty much everyone agrees that the large facts point in terms of extreme finance and large global imbalance. Where there needs to be more understanding is the source for this large global imbalance. I pointed in the direction of where that has come from, and I've told you that understanding that direction, understanding those causes, is actually reason for optimism, even in the state of the world economy that we see around us, and especially optimism for economies that are globalized and that are resource rich in either commodities or natural resources. Thank you.
Thank you for this. I would say an economist with an optimistic view. Our second speaker is Sir Howard Davis. By the way, I didn't introduce the speakers or the bio of the speakers. You have it in the folder, so just if you need more information about our speakers. The topic is domestic and global implications of sovereign wealth funds.
Thank you. There's another slide, thank you. I'm going to move from Danny's rather high-level view of what's been going on in the global economy to just one dimension of it, but which... Okay. Thanks. Yeah, that's fine. But which does, I think, fit quite well with his analysis, because, in a sense, the growth of sovereign wealth funds is in part... a consequence of some of the imbalances, though only in part, as I will show. The chairman pointed out that for a while the activities of sovereign wealth funds have been flavour of the month internationally and in the media. That's not quite the position at the moment, for some reasons that I'll come on to explain. But my general point is that this is still potentially a destabilising factor in the world economy, unless both the sovereign wealth funds themselves and the host countries behave rather carefully. Now, what I want to do is to tell you something about the build-up of sovereign wealth funds and how their activities have changed, and then come on to talk about the way in which that leads into some of the sort of politico-economic issues that arise. And interestingly, you couldn't really have a more appropriate place to have this conversation than Kuwait, because if you look at some of the histories of sovereign wealth funds, typically they are dated back to 1953, when the Kuwait Investment Board was established, of course, when Kuwait was still comfortably being looked after by my predecessors in Whitehall. So a British Kuwait conference is absolutely the perfect place to begin a discussion of sovereign wealth funds, since it started here. Now, what I was going to do then is to talk a bit about the context and then, as I say, some of the issues that arise. I should say, first of all, that putting numbers on sovereign wealth funds is quite a tricky activity because, as we know, and I'll come on to show, they're not always the most transparent of vehicles. Also, of course, the figures are rapidly changing at the moment, and I'm quite sure that the numbers that were assembled around the end of 2008 are not an as the saying now goes, mark to market. I should imagine if you marked all this to market, you'd find somewhat lower figures at the moment. But for what it's worth, the best figures that I think one can find suggest that around the end of 2008, there was something like $3.9 trillion in sovereign wealth funds. And the ones I'm going to talk about are the ones on the left-hand side of the chart as you look at it, which are the ones that are categorised here as commodity funds and non-commodity funds. And the words commodity and non-commodity mean the source of the funds. In other words, that's not where they invest. So the commodity funds are the ones that primarily arise in oil exporters, not exclusively, and the non-commodity funds arise where from large exporters who have accumulated large current account balances, which they have then used in part for sovereign wealth funds. And I'm not going to talk about the management of official foreign exchange reserves or some of the other vehicles. Now, if you look at how the market has grown, of the top 40 sovereign wealth funds, so about a third of them go back to before 1990, but in the last 8 years, there's been a rapid growth. So there are almost twice as many sovereign wealth funds now as there were a decade ago. And, of course, the big one is the new CIC in China, but also countries like Libya have chosen to set up really quite a sizable fund, about $80 billion, and to set it up sort of straight away with a large endowment of money to invest. And I think it's this growth of new funds from places like China and Libya that has explained the higher prominence, together also with a somewhat different investment strategy undertaken by these funds, as I'll come on to explain. Now, there was a question earlier about why it makes sense for a country like Kuwait to have a sovereign wealth fund which invests overseas. So maybe it's just worth setting out what are cited usually as the reasons for countries to have a sovereign wealth fund of the sort I'm discussing. The first, which Will referred to briefly at the end of his presentation this morning, is what you might call intergenerational transfers, that you are investing in order to pay future pensions or conceivably unemployment benefit or whatever from the fruits of today's exports. And you're essentially investing the fruits of today's surpluses so that you can have the benefit of being able to use those perhaps when your oil has run out or when your large trade surplus is no longer achievable. Secondly, to diversify your income to respond to potential shocks to your current competitive advantage or comparative advantage. So again, that might be because you may think that the oil price at $140 is not going to be sustained, as indeed I'm sure Kuwait did think, and that in fact if you invest in other assets then that are not directly correlated with oil, when the oil price goes down, then you at least have some sort of cushion. So there's an intergenerational point, an income diversification point. Thirdly, and this relates to the particular type of sovereign wealth funds that have been set up and which have raised controversial questions in the West, or in particular in America, has been to increase your return on assets. I mean, clearly the Chinese motivation for setting up CIC, which they pretty much expressed in openly, was that they had eventually come to the conclusion that just piling up US Treasury bills on which they were earning 1% or so was not necessarily a smart investment strategy, and some kind of diversification of investment in order to increase your return on assets made some sense. And then the fourth argument, which is quite a delicate one and which you hear few funds talk about explicitly but which does appear to emerge from some of the investment strategies they've pursued, is to promote inward investment and indeed technology transfer. That in some cases sovereign wealth funds have bought whole companies in order to get access to their technology, or have bought controlling stakes which have then had as a consequence the investment activity of that company back in the home country. Clearly that is a more delicate area and does introduce political and, as it were, strategic objectives for investment, which may cause some nervousness on the part of host countries, and we'll come on to say a bit more about that. So for that combination of reasons, what we've seen is a pretty large growth in assets under management. And going from about $1.5 trillion around the turn of the century up to, as I say, $3.9 trillion in 2008. And there are some forecasts by McKinsey and others which suggest that this could double in the next 7 years. Frankly, I think these forecasts all arose before the scale of the financial crisis was fully appreciated, so I wouldn't attach too much importance to them. But clearly, this growth of 2.5 times since the turn of the century has been pretty dramatic and was bound to attract people's attention. But before we go on to what they did with that money, and whether it's right that the world's attention was attracted, it is worth just looking at the volumes in some context. And sovereign wealth funds, this is frustratingly on from a slightly different source, actually, a man called Balin at Johns Hopkins, who obviously has some slightly different categorization of sovereign wealth funds, produces a figure of 3.2 rather than 3.9 trillion. But on these figures, it shows that they still, I mean, they're twice as big as hedge funds. Nonetheless, they're only about 15% of mutual funds and about one-fifth of pension fund holdings. So one needs to think about this in context. However, of course, another figure would be that they are significantly bigger than official aid flows, and of course, they are significantly less constrained in their investment strategies than are mutual funds and pension funds, who have a lot of regulatory requirements wrapped around them in terms of what they can invest. A lot of them, of course, have essentially tracking philosophies, which means that their ability to take large strategic stakes in companies and to take over whole companies, etc., is significantly constrained. So sovereign wealth funds, while not huge in terms of the total investable funds in the world, are nonetheless very large in terms of the size of funds which can be deployed on a large scale and for strategic purposes and not linked to any kind of tracking index, and of course not linked, as mutual funds and pension funds are, to some specific liability obligations with a time profile which significantly constrains what they are allowed to do. If you then look at this by country and look at the market shares, where are these funds to be found? Well, the UAE is still the dominant one, with China has grown very rapidly. This includes safe money as well. Singapore, both GIC and Temasek together. And so you can see that it's largely from the Far East and from this region, though, of course, with Norway significant in there as well. And the largest individual funds, these again are somewhat speculative numbers produced by a sovereign wealth fund institute, but I mean, the GIC, for example, does not publish a balance sheet, so we don't absolutely know that, but I think they're probably reasonable numbers as sort of informed guesstimates is what I would describe them as. And if you look at the oil countries, you can see that sovereign wealth funds are now about a half of their foreign investment assets and are now considerably larger than central bank reserve assets and larger than the private wealth of high net worth individuals, much of which, of course, finds its way into other investment vehicles such as hedge funds. We then come on to what they've actually been doing. So we've seen that a large growth in the number of funds, funds set up by countries that didn't have them before. Assets under management has been growing quite rapidly and are very significant, certainly as funds that can be deployed for strategic aims. And this is what's been happening to cross-border activity. Whether this is totally comprehensive, I'm not sure. This is, another different data source from an outfit called Dealogic. But this shows the $1 billion of cross-border deals by sovereign wealth funds, as I have defined them, on the left-hand side, and the number of deals on the right-hand side. And this, as you can see, rose very sharply in 05, 06, and 07, fell back in 2008, but still in 2008 was very large and still was twice as big as in 2006. And clearly it's these large cross-border deals that have raised concerns in the host countries. And you can see from this why it became flavour of the month. It's not surprising if you look at these numbers. And this is a similar pattern, in a way, to the purchases of US Treasury bonds and notes, which of course rose very sharply in 06, 07 and have since been falling back. These, of course, are also, some of them, are bought by sovereign wealth funds, although by no means all. And China, of course, they've said very clearly and are rather worried about whether this is a particularly good investment strategy, which, as I say, was part of the background for setting up CIC. And so this large volume of overseas of cross-border deals was clearly the origin of considerable concern, especially in the US, and of course it got focused around the Dubai ports deal, but it was not by any means the only one. And interestingly, the country in which the concern was most raised in the US is a country in which in fact does have a framework for addressing foreign deals through the CFIUS process. The Germans have now set up a sort of parallel process. The UK doesn't have one. Everything's for sale in the UK, as you know, except the LSE, I should point out, which you couldn't afford anyway. But this process of large volumes of deals changed the mood about sovereign wealth funds, which were previously seen as benign. But interestingly, in terms of popular mood, this was quite rapidly offset, this concern about
people coming in and buying strategic US assets, when it turned out that actually the US rather needed the money, or indeed some parts of the US needed the money, and we then had these large capital infusions by sovereign wealth funds into distressed financial institutions. Not, of course, all in the US, but many of them. And it suddenly turned out that far from being the big bad wolves who were buying ports in New York, they were actually the fairy godmother who was prepared to cough up large sums of money to fill in holes in balance sheets of US institutions created by unwise adventures into the mortgage market. And these deals, of course, have produced significant losses, which itself has caused an issue in some of the countries from which these investments have come. The Morgan Stanley deal, for example, where I do have the figures in my head since I'm on the board, there, that stake of 10% cost $5 billion, and today you could buy it for 2.5. And that is probably the best deal on this page, because so certainly you could buy 12.7% of Citigroup for considerably less than $22 billion. I can't do the numbers in my head, but probably if we all emptied our pockets now, we could buy 12.7% of Citibank between us. Clearly, these were, in some cases, pretty spectacularly bad deals, at least in the short term. And they have generated considerable controversy in the home countries, which, of course, has expressed itself in different ways, depending on the political culture from which they come. But, I mean, even in China, where the boss of CIC is not exactly going to get voted out, nonetheless, he and his colleagues are not popular people, and that there's been a lot of coverage in the Chinese blogosphere of these investments. And, of course, in Singapore, there has been a change at the top of Temasek just recently, which has been widely seen to be related to their investments. Before addressing that question in a little bit more detail, there's the question then bubbled up in 07 and 08 about the role of sovereign wealth funds. And the expression of this in the policymaking fraternity, as opposed to being on the front page of the newspapers, was to ask the IMF to set up a group to look at it, and particularly to look at whether these funds were dangerously opaque and unaccountable, and whether there shouldn't be some sort of quasi-regulatory framework put around them. And it is true that these funds are not so transparent as other investors. There's some interesting analysis of this, and some people, an outfit called Lineberg Madwell, have produced something called the Transparency Index. So the green ones are the big funds, the over $100 billion funds, and the red ones are the under $100 billion, or in Temasek's case, actually, they're about $100 billion. And they, I won't go into the details of what they do, but I mean, roughly, do they reveal the size of their balance sheet? Do they reveal the sectoral composition of their investments? Do they reveal their investment objectives, etc.? And as you can see, there's quite a bit of difference here with Temasek and the Norwegian fund being really quite transparent, Libya and particularly the Iranian fund saying very little about their investments, what they're doing, etc. So clearly it was right that there were differences, considerable differences about transparency. Why do they arise? Well, interestingly, there is quite a high correlation, in fact, between the transparency of the sovereign wealth fund, which is on the x-axis, which is roughly a transposition of the index on the previous slide, and the quality of the legal system on the y-axis. In fact, in a slide which seems to have slipped out of my presentation, there's actually an even closer link between the transparency of the sovereign wealth fund and an index of democratic accountability, which is actually really quite a tight fit. Once again, Kuwait, as you'll see, sort of is bang in the middle of this. which is sort of halfway up on transparency and halfway up on their democratic accountability. The Singaporean one, GIC, is somewhat of an outlier, which of course is in a very strong legal system, but which is not very transparent, and Temasek is actually rather in the middle, and you can see the Norwegian funds up in the top right-hand corner. So clearly, this transparency issue is actually quite closely related to the nature of the country from which they come. So as I say, the IMF was asked in response to this, to the concerns about cross-border deals, to look at the possibility of setting in place some kind of regulatory framework. And eventually, last September, they produced some generally accepted principles and practices. Apparently there was an argument for several months as to what they should be called, which are now called the Santiago Principles. And some of them, of course, are clearly in the nature of motherhood. The legal framework should be sound. Well, that's helpful to know. Some of them do get a little bit closer into recommendations that mean something. Although, as you can see from recommendation 19, that investment decisions should aim to maximise risk-adapted returns consistent with investment policy, well, that does beg rather a lot of questions, although it does suggest that the fund should state an investment policy and should produce some approximation to the returns. And I say even the Singapore fund, which is not hugely transparent on where its assets are, does in fact produce some figures on returns over a period. What will happen on these principles is not completely clear. I think the IMF have been asked to go back and look at compliance with them over time, and a number of the funds are changing their reporting practices to bring them up to compliance with these principles. But it is, I think, you might say, a fairly fragile basis of regulation. So, finally, what are the remaining issues in the light of the picture that we have seen? Well, I think you can first of all say there is the question of host government attitudes and the risk of protectionism against these funds arising from their activities. I think we might say now, as we perhaps wouldn't have done 18 months ago, that this should be seen really as part of a general problem of the growth of protectionist sentiment in a number of different countries. And in fact, over the last year, I think the concerns on protectionism have risen more in relation to the nature of the conditions put on bailouts or the nature of the bailouts in manufacturing companies, etc., rather than as specific response to sovereign wealth fund investment, because I think sovereign wealth funds have actually been quite cautious in the last 12 months about what they have invested in. Whether that caution has been simply because they were awaiting Will Hutton's verdict on when they should invest in the US equity market, and now they've received it, off they'll go and invest further in the US equity market, or whether this was because they were cautious politically, I'm not quite sure. The second big set of issues is, of course, what is happening in home countries. How effective will the sovereign wealth funds be and the governments who own them at explaining why it makes sense to have these funds at all? And certainly you are hearing people who are advocating that this has been a waste of time, that actually they've gone and wasted money bailing out Western institutions, and why on earth should they do that? I mean, it's tough enough to explain to an American taxpayer why she should bail out Citigroup. Imagine being given the task of explaining to a Chinese taxpayer or a Singaporean taxpayer why he should bail out Merrill Lynch. I mean, this is not an easy argument to advance. So I think that we will see some interesting discipline on sovereign wealth funds at home, of course, depending on the nature of the democratic and legal environment in which they operate. And I think there is clearly the risk of some kind of backlash from the investment strategies of these funds. And the third question, of course, is what type of investment strategy they will operate in the upturn. Now, most of them, of course, say that they are not operating in a political way, and indeed they are simply return maximizers and long-term investors like everybody else, and therefore why should anyone fear them? Indeed, interestingly, the only sovereign wealth fund that has an explicit set of political aims is the Norwegian one, which has been explicit about the nature of the companies in which it will not invest. And indeed, the Norwegian fund carried out a process of disinvestment from arms companies and other companies in which whose practices they did not approve. Interestingly, the ECB have analysed this disinvestment process in some detail and have suggested that it showed, in fact, no impact, that there was no impact on the prices of the companies from which they disinvested. So, in other words, they've measured the price behaviour of British Aerospace against UK industrials before, during and after the Norwegian fund disinvested, when they had a reasonably sizable stake, and they can find no price performance impact. So even though we may have some concerns in theory about politically driven investment, interestingly, the one example we've had of politically driven disinvestment has actually created no market disruption at all. At the moment, of course, this issue is rather quieter, since in fact there's been an incentive for banks in the West to try to persuade these funds to have directed investment strategies, which were not necessarily short-term, at least short-term profit-related. But I think that issue is quieter. But my final point really is that whilst at the moment this has, as Chairman said, gone slightly out of focus in the popular mind, I think it could become a sensitive issue once again at any time, because this new equilibrium that we are in rests on a degree of self-denial by the sovereign wealth funds in terms of the aggressiveness of their investment strategies on the one hand, and a degree of self-denial and tolerance on the part of host country, investee countries, if you like, on the other. And self-denial is, in my personal experience, a relatively fragile basis for an equilibrium. So I think this issue is one which we will need to come back to, and indeed at the LSE we have some ambitions to work rather more intensively on sovereign wealth funds, in fact under Danny Quarr in the future, which we think could be a rather fruitful avenue of academic inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you, Sir Davies. I believe the issue of sovereign wealth fund will be with us. I just want to mention last September in University of Virginia, 19 former finance ministers was in a conference hosted by the university, and they came up with an announcement that was submitted to the IMF World Bank annual meeting in Washington, D.C. And I was representing Kuwait as a former Minister of Finance, and John Snow, the former U.S. Secretary of Treasury, the one who organized this conference. I was amazed how some of the former finance ministers, especially from Canada and Australia, were against the sovereign wealth funds, and they were talking about special regulations to the sovereign wealth funds without any attempt to distinguish between the different sovereign wealth funds. And as you mentioned, some of these sovereign wealth funds, they have different strategies. One like to diversify away from domestic economy like Kuwait. Others, they like to integrate their economies through investment abroad, like Qatar and Dubai. Others, they want to acquire certain technology, like Korea and China. So I believe, and the issue of transparency, it really needs to be revisited. I just want to give an example about the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Kuwait. It goes through really very thorough transparency. One, it goes through the Audit Bureau, which is an independent institution. And second, to go through the approval of the National Assembly, our parliament. Not publishing the data doesn't mean it's not transparent. So I think accountability and governance is a very important issue. I don't want to talk about this issue, but I believe I agree with Sir Davids that this issue will come up in the near future and need to be really discussed in a fair way to hear the views of the Sovereign Wealth Fund views on these issues. And I believe the new economic and financial development, many of these sovereign wealth funds are going to revisit their investment policies and also the allocation of these investments around the world. The last but not least speaker of this distinguished speakers is Dr. Silvina Tenreiro, and she will talk about volatility, diversification, and development in GCC economies.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'd like to discuss volatility, diversification, and development in GCC countries. And I should say that most of this work has been done with Miklós Koren, who's now at the Central European University in Hungary. So let me try to... Okay, it's not working. There you go. Okay, so I talk first about the evolution of growth and volatility in GCC countries in the last four decades, and then I will discuss the sources of this volatility, and I'll be more explicit in a few minutes. Just to be clear, when I say growth here, I mean the growth rate of real GDP per capita, and by volatility I mean the standard deviation of growth rate. So concretely, sharper or more frequent fluctuations in GDP, both up and down, will lead to a higher measure of volatility. So let me start by showing the general trends for Saudi Arabia, which turns out to be quite representative of other GCC countries, except for Kuwait, which has had a very different economic history, in part because of the war. So this plot here shows the evolution of growth rates and volatility in Saudi Arabia in the last four decades. In blue, you can see the average growth rate over the decade, and in red, the level of volatility over the same decade. So specifically, you see that in the 70s, growth rates were just below 6% on average. They then fell to minus 6% in the 80s, they reached zero, slightly positive in the 90s, and then again they became decidedly positive. Yeah, thank you. And they became positive again at in the early 2000s. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks. Now, for volatility, we see a steady decline over time. From a maximum of about 8% in the 70s to less than 3% in the early 2000s. Now, this data go up until 2006. Of course, 2007 and 2008 have been expansionary, and of course, the current global downturn will have a detrimental effect both on growth and GDP, but all in all, one can say that Saudi Arabia is very well positioned now to face the downturn. The second figure shows the same result. Okay. The second figure shows the same trend for trends for other GCC countries. You see Bahrain, Oman, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. Bottom right. And again, generally speaking, all countries grew in the 70s except for Qatar. Then they had negative growth rates in the 80s, then growth rates pick up again in the 90s, and again and more decisively in the early 2000s. Volatility has declined steadily in all countries, except in Qatar, where it remained quite stable, although starting from much lower levels. And finally, this last picture shows the trends for Kuwait. Again, growth rates were negative in the 70s and 80s. They picked up after the war to reach an average of above 4% over the 90s, and then again about 4% in the early 2000s. Volatility increased markedly until the early 90s, so we see this mostly driven by the war, and then declined sharply in the early 2000s. So the early 2000s have basically met GCC countries with very low levels of volatility and positive and strongly positive growth rates. Now, to a large extent, these gains or declines in volatility are due to gains in diversification. So most of GCC economies have diversified away from oil, particularly into financial services, education, health, tourism, and real estate. And let me illustrate this point by starting with Saudi Arabia. Here you can see the shares of GDP for different sectors in Saudi Arabia from 1970 to 2006. And highlighted in red is the sector mining and utilities, which comprises oil. And you can see how it declined quite dramatically from almost 80% of the economy in the mid-70s to less than 50% of GDP by 2006. And most of the gains have been posted by relative gains by services, particularly financial services, as I said, education, health, and real estate. There was also an increase in manufacturing, which was virtually inexistent at the beginning of the sample and reached about 10% by the end of the sample. The second graph shows, or set of figures, shows the developments in the other GCC countries. Again, we have Bahrain in the top left, Oman, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. And we see particularly in UAE a sharp decline in the relative importance of oil in the economy and a large gain in services, which is also very apparent for Bahrain and Oman and Qatar. Finally, this graph shows the same picture for Kuwait. Again, we see that the sector has gone from more than 80% in the mid-70s, 80% of the economy, to about 50% of the economy by the end of the sample. Okay? And again, with the corresponding gain in services mostly. So what I would like to do now is talk about the sources of this volatility and whether something can be done to reduce it even further. Okay, so we discuss in the paper how to decompose volatility in basically three main components. The first component is, which we call the sectoral volatility. It captures the volatility due to sectoral shocks. Those shocks can be global, affecting all countries in the same way, or idiosyncratic, affecting different countries in different ways. Okay, so this first component of volatility will capture, for example, any shock to the oil sector, changes in prices. The second component relates to the volatility due to domestic shocks. And here you can think of shocks or fluctuations due to policy or political instability that affect all sectors in the economy in the same direction. And finally, the third component captures the covariance between these aggregate domestic shocks and the sectoral shocks mentioned before. And so, for example, if you have a very aggressive counter-cyclical policy that in times of expansion or high prices of oil, you save more, for example, that will lead to a very negative covariance or low covariance and hence contribute to lower volatility. Pro-cyclicality in policies will lead to obviously high covariance and hence tend to increase volatility. Okay, so let me start by showing the first component of volatility due to sectoral shocks for all countries in the world, plotted against the level of development, which is here on the horizontal axis. So in the vertical axis, you see the volatility due to sectoral shocks, and the horizontal axis, the level of development of the country. And I hope you can see, I highlighted GCC countries in red here. And the point to note here is that, generally speaking, there is a negative relation between volatility due to sectoral shocks and the level of development. As countries develop, they tend to move into sectors that are either less risky or less volatile, or to diversify the economy more. So this measure of volatility in general tends to reduce. GCC countries are a bit of outliers here, so given their level of development, they tend to have much higher exposure to shocks, and hence this component of volatility is very high. Here I just contrasted or plotted in a similar graph, but only for countries that are richly endowed with natural resources. So here, besides GCC countries, I plotted Norway, Netherlands, Colombia, Indonesia. And you can see that even compared to countries that are resource-rich, GCC countries tend to be above the level that one would expect given their development levels. But this plot, I should say, is for 2005. What we see is that there has been quite some progress if we compare to the results from 1975, where GCC countries were even more outliers in some sense. So as you can see here, they were much more above the line linking volatility due to sectoral shocks and the level of development. So the second component of volatility that I mentioned is the volatility due to domestic aggregate shocks. Right? So here, again, you can see that there is a negative relation with the level of development. But again, GCC countries tend to show much higher volatility than other countries at the same level of development. And similarly, much higher volatility if we compare them to countries that are endowed that are also rich in natural resources. This is something that could be perhaps reduced by trying to reduce volatility in policy variables. And I'll talk a little bit more in a second about what I mean. And finally, this is the covariance component, which captures the correlation between these aggregate fluctuations and fluctuations that are sector-specific. And the relation is mostly flat for all countries vis-à-vis the level of development. But again, GCC countries tend to display positive levels and above the average for given their level of development. And same thing if we compare them with other countries that are resource rich. So I think if one looks at this graph, there are three messages one can take away. First of all, that there has been great progress in terms of stabilizing GCC economies. As we saw, volatility has been flying dramatically if we take a longer-term perspective. Obviously, the current downturn, as we say, will have an effect, but the economies are quite strong right now. It's a very different position from what they where they were in the 70s. The second point is that there seems to be scope for more countercyclical policies, that is, more saving in times of even more savings in times of booms and perhaps more expansionary policies when oil prices fall. So there is an even bigger role for wealth funds, according to this. And the final point, which I just mentioned, is that, again, my view is much more optimistic. I think the countries, GCC countries, are very well positioned to face the current downturn and in a sense, given their the gains posted in the last 10 years in particular, they are very strongly positioned to overcome the crisis. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we have some time for questions. Please.
Okay, I think that should work.
Your name first, please.
So, my name is Stefan Hertog, and I'm from the other Kuwait program at Sciences Po in Paris. I've got a rather technical question on what we just heard from Silvana, and that is whether you measure real total GDP or real non-oil GDP. Because if you measure real total GDP, that it includes the oil sector, but the only thing it picks up when you measure it in real terms is the production volume, because the price is fixed to some arbitrary baseline year. And because the GCC countries were among the better citizens in OPEC in the 1980s, and in particular Saudi Arabia, did a lot to reduce its own production to keep prices constant, I think a lot of the higher fluctuation is explained with the fact that oil production in the 80s went down much more strongly in the GCC economies than it did in other oil exporting economies. So in that sense, it might be more interesting to look at non-oil GDP in your measurement of volatility. And I would like to hear about that and whether you have used some alternative specifications to how you measure GDP and volatility.
Can we have more questions?
Oh, yeah.
Please.
Yes, I'll just add that relates to the last paper, actually, so it fits in quite well. I mean, you looked at Kuwait as a kind of outlier in relation to the 1980s, and you said it was, you know, war, conflict was the explanation. But there were other things happening in Kuwait as well. There was the Souk Al-Manakh crisis, for example, which was clearly pretty destabilizing. Other economies had nothing like that in the GCC, so maybe you should be looking at that as well. The other issue is, of course, the non-oil sector. Coming to that, I mean, there's the issue about how stable that was, given a lot of it was financial services, not just in Kuwait, but right across the GCC, which hasn't been especially stable, I think, if you look at the... So it might be worth investigating.
Great.
I would like to check with Silviana. Sorry, does this mean, according to the policy conclusions you were giving from this study, that diversification in the Gulf countries is going well, taking the numbers and analysis from 70 to 2006, does it mean they are on the right track in diversifying their economies and achieving that economic goal? This is one question. The other one about the sovereign wealth funds. Well, I don't know why we have been all following, I mean, at least I from my work, following the foreign direct investment. And either we know it's the private companies, the multinational companies that are carrying that FDI. Now, the sovereign funds are actually more government-owned funds, but they're still part of the integration of the world economy. I'm still wondering why, when they were saving Citibank and others, they were blessed, and why, when they wanted to diversify the country's economy, like the Dubai case of Dubai ports, they became cursed and sensitive, and the issues of sovereignty came from the industrialized countries, which were leaders of encouraging liberalization and free movement of cross-countries capitals. And why are they different from any mergers and acquisitions that take place in the private sector? Why all this sensitivity? Thank you.
Sir.
Adil Malik from the Center for Islamic Studies. I think it's, my question relates to Silvana's question.
Mike.
Okay. So my question relates to Silvana's presentation. I think it was a pretty remarkable fact that the GCC countries are an outlier compared to other resource-abundant countries when you look at the nature of relationship between sectoral shocks and GDP. I think it's interesting for us to think a little deeper why that might be so, apart from the sort of technical reasons that Stefan has pointed out. I, for instance, would be interested in looking at what is whether Iran is an outlier or not. And it would be interesting to look at why the GCC countries might be similar or different from Iran's performance on that. Is it to do with the fact that a lot of GCC countries are high-rent per capita economies? Is it to do with the fact that the shrinkage of the private sector, in a sense, is more pronounced in GCC relative to other resource-abundant countries? And indeed, to look at other possible political economy explanations for that. I think that's where a lot of interesting work could be done.
Sir.
I just have another observation for Silvana. I'm sorry, you're inundated with the comments. Whether you'd like to actually yourself perhaps make a comment on the depth of the diversification, if I can put it like that. You mentioned the trends in Saudi and Kuwait from 80% of GDP down to 50 from the 70s to the present day. How much can we think of that as, in a sense, diversification as we might in other non-oil-based economies, the extent to which a lot of this investment, capital investment, is coming from the public sector and therefore oil-fueled and oil-funded? And a second, if I may, a quick comment, just in terms of the major differences. The most obvious one, Saudi's GDP per capita figure. So when you had extreme volatility in terms of the oil price in the early 80s or the late 1970s, it had a huge impact on Saudi in a way that obviously wouldn't in the much smaller oil economies. That seems to be a factor that might be worth making note of.
Silvana, would you like to answer? The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much for the comments. I actually don't think the picture changes that much as you would expect if you look at real versus nominal.
The average. Not nominal, non-oil GDP.
Yeah, well, that's easy to work out because you've seen the picture of the shares of GDP. Those are calculated in nominal terms. So the second set of figures, yeah?
But no, that wasn't the point. The point was that
I was trying to make the point that a lot of the volatility is caused by the oil sector,
yeah,
and that you should just look at non-oil GDP. You could do that in real terms, or you can do that in nominal terms. That mm-hmm. wouldn't make such a big difference. But I think because oil production fluctuated more in the GCC countries than other resource exporters, that artificially increases the volatility of the whole economy if you just look at aggregate GDP, and it, depending on the baseline you use, the baseline year, it does that much more or much less. If you got a very low oil price base year, say 1985 or 1986, then it's not going to make a big difference. If you use 1973 or 1974, then it's going to make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, that's your point. The question on whether diversification is in the right track. I mean, I think there has been a lot of diversification, but still, it's obviously all GCC economies are still very highly dependent on oil, it's inescapable. I mean, that's where their comparative advantage is, and the way to smooth, in some sense, the shocks of oil prices is precisely through wealth funds, sovereign wealth funds. Regarding Iran, I mean, again, so we see this as a general trend for countries. As they develop, they tend to diversify more and also move into sectors that are intrinsically less volatile, like services in general, except for financial services. Yes, I think it would be interesting to look deeper into political economy issues driving this diversification. I think that's less likely to affect the sectoral measures, but more the aggregate shocks or the volatility due to macroeconomic shocks.
Same thing.
Yeah. On the sovereign wealth fund point, I thought the US reaction on the Dubai ports deal was rather extraordinary, so I wouldn't want to try to defend it. But I think that the issues that people raise are which justify taking a different attitude to sovereign wealth fund investments are, put generally, whether they are taking a non-commercial approach. And behind that, people say, well, maybe they are investing in order to acquire the technology. Having acquired the technology, they'll then not be interested in the investment that they've undertaken and may even run the company down, and that they may be simply doing things which are for objectives which are not related to the development of the company. So that normally the logic would be, well, if one of British companies or American companies is worth more in the hands of a foreign purchaser, they must have a logic for developing it further. Therefore, we should, in general terms, benefit from that investment. If it's a sovereign wealth fund that has other criteria in mind, maybe that's not to be assumed. And I think it's that argumentation that led to the track of having sovereign wealth funds be under some obligation to explain what their investment strategy is. And that's what led to the terms of the Santiago principles, so that a fund could be held to the investment strategy that it adopted, and if you didn't like its investment strategy, then you would have a reason to object to its investment. So I think that's the train of argument, though, as I say, I don't think that was particularly well established in the Dubai ports deal, actually.
Yes, I have, again, to come back on the sovereign wealth fund, a question for Sir Howard. You know, back in 1988, the Kuwait Investment Office bought 21.6% of British Petroleum, upon which Margaret Thatcher, presiding the most liberal government in the West, and as you said, you know, Britain is open for sale, requested the Monopolies and Mergers Commission to issue an opinion, which I have always consistently used since then as a reading in my classes, because I think it defines a red line, you know. And that said, of course, that it was intolerable, and that the key IO should sell this participation. And so it happened. Okay, KIO made a good profit in that occasion, while people that have invested in Citi have made losses recently. But you know, I think any attempt to theorize the attitude towards foreign investment, especially state-led foreign investment, is difficult because we have such opposite reactions. The Austrians are not afraid of Abu Dhabi owning a large chunk of OMV and all the consequences of that. But Britain was afraid of KIO owning BP. Today, if some of the people that have invested in Citi were to, offer publicly to take over Citi, which would greatly make life easier for the American administration and so on and so forth, they would probably be told, no, you cannot buy Citi purely and simply, wouldn't they? So all of this looks like gut's feeling, doesn't it?
Thank you, Fis. I would like to appreciate and thanks the distinguished speakers for their lectures. And back to the issue of the also sovereignty wealth funds. I don't see, actually, from Professor Losiani's last comment, anything wrong with a liberal government like Thatcher asking the Kuwaiti government to sell the stake in on the PV, because at that time, you know, when you think about between the issue of the ownership between the private sector and the public sector, looking at these as a foreign government trying to take a stake in a private company, probably it will look, you know, something rational to not to have a public sector in control. But now, coming back, if the issue is that people are scared of having government or foreign government to control, and that's a very important issue in the United Kingdom, if you go back to the debate about that the French is owning the electricity company, which is provide London City with electricity, and the debate which was going on in Britain, one can understand the sensitivity of this issue. But now, if this is the issue, do you think, this is a question to Professor Davis, do you think this will be a part of the debates in the future regarding of shall we allow government to have a control or the, again, the distinguish between the role of the government and the role of the private sector in owning assets in the capital market? Thank you.
Mr. Hamid.
Shukran. I have observed from the data presented by Sir Howard Davis that three factors, the world GDP and the market capitalization and the world debt, they are all around 43 trillion. Is that a coincidence, or historically they have to be close to each other? And this closeness, does it give some economic implications? Thank you.
Danny Kwa is going to answer the last question. Because I don't think I know the answer to that, but I'm sure he does. On the other two, I mean, the nice thing is that it's always nice when two questioners sort of answer each other, which is, I think our professors always like to engineer that in their classes. But, I mean, I would just say, in general terms, that you're absolutely right in the sense that you will never find a sort of regulatory environment or a set of principles or whatever which will remove politics. There will always be circumstances in which there will be adverse political reactions to particular purchases and from particular places, which may have motivations and causes which are quite unrelated to the particular deal in question. So I certainly think that the efforts to illuminate the activities of sovereign wealth funds, the effort to make them more transparent, get them to fit themselves within a framework of disclosure, etc., are not going to mean that we can put this issue to bed definitively and put it onto autopilot. You know, I don't think it's going to be that way. But I do think it's possible to minimize the disruptive arguments, if you like, and that some of the assertions made about sovereign wealth funds in the past, some of the assertions made about, you know, what their real motives are, have not been right and can probably be dealt with by a code. You know, I think that many of them do genuinely have purely commercial motives, and indeed, interestingly, you might say that the fuss that there's been about some of their investments domestically is tending to push in the same direction as the concerns on the other side, if you see what I mean. That you know, both the home country electorates, whether electorates or popular opinion, want them to be long-term commercial, just as the recipients of their investment want them to be. So the optimist in me says that this will probably, the disputes about sovereign wealth funds will probably narrow down and not be quite so emotive as they have been at times in the last 2 or 3 years. But I completely agree with the sense of what you say, that there will be always be circumstances in which politics will dominate a rational view of an investment proposition. And as far as the issue about the role of government in the future, well, you may well be right. My feeling is, however, that in many cases, certainly in the case of the UK government owning banks, and of course it now owns or majority of them in two cases. I should emphasise, since I don't think that Will made this point, that we have had a Scottish banking crisis. You know, there's no English banking crisis, as you know. but the government has ended up owning one big Scottish... Yes, and a Scottish Prime Minister. That's his problem. But I think that in the UK case, and I suspect this will be true in others, that the preoccupation will be to sell down these stakes before there's any question of these institutions going and buying things overseas. You know, so indeed, the opposite is the case at the moment. You know, they're typically, and indeed that's the case in the US as well, they're typically divesting overseas stakes in order to shore up their balance sheets and in order to get themselves out of the hands of the government. And I think that that'll be the dynamic first. So I think that it's unlikely that you're going to find a state-owned, a majority state-owned bank from Europe or North America seeking activist investments in other countries. So I think that your concern, while I can see theoretically it may be there, I think in practice it's not going to be a serious one.
Danny, would you like to... Quickly
on the... If I can pick up as well, Howard, some of these points about national pride or national feelings and, you know, the feel that essential utilities might be owned by a foreign government. I think some countries, like in the US especially, there's the same fear of not just foreign governments owning essential utilities, but domestic governments owning essential utilities. The nationalization of large banks is the phenomenon that dare not speak its name in the United States. And I think some of it might have to do with fears about how economic performance might be different. And that's why publication of the sovereign wealth fund principles, sovereign wealth fund operating principles, might help along this process. On the issue of whether world GDP, world debt, and other indicators of, you know, other world indicators might be naturally related in some way, there's a quick technical answer, which isn't very interesting, and then there's some other speculation. So the quick technical answer is that there need not be, because, you know, one, one is a stock and the other is a flow. The stock of world debt is something that stands at a point in time. World GDP is something that happens over a particular time period. So the stock of world debt is going to be the same whether you look at it at the end of the first quarter in 2009 or whether you look at it at the end of the year 2009. But of course, world GDP over the year will have been different depending on whether you measure it as a quarterly flow or as an annual flow. So there's no natural relation between one and the other. That's the technical answer. The more interesting answer, I think, is that at some level, world debt, when you add up what everybody owes, has to be owed to somebody else in the world. So total world debt has to add up to zero, you know, excluding the possibility of trade with outer space. Total world debt is always zero, regardless of what world GDP is. The more interesting spin, I think, that you're trying to sort of get to is how large must the global financial industry be, total, relative to, say, the flow of world GDP? How much finance do we need to facilitate the operation of markets and goods and services? And there, I think, we come up to some interesting possibilities. Right now, the global financial industry is between $170 and $200 trillion. That's about four times what world GDP is. And so the question is, as we go through the process of financial deleveraging, are we going to see a severe downsizing of that global financial industry? And that, I think, is an open question, and it is an interesting question.
Any more questions?
Professor Dani has an excellent lecture and very enlightening, and especially the way you tackled the issue. I came a bit late, but you talked about the trade finance deficit. What about the budget deficit? Because U.S. has the twin deficits only, and we know how they are interactive. If you can shed a quick light on it.
Any other questions?
Dr. Ekman. Clarification on Danny's previous answer. It's true that the total net debt of the world is zero, but that doesn't tell us much. I think what we need to look at is not, you know, I owe you 100 billion and you owe someone else 100 billion, so they cancel out. But what is the outlay there that creates action and dynamics? So I go back to the question. I mean, yes, of course, it zeroes out at the end of the day, but is there a relationship between the underlying movement and the dynamics?
Okay. So very quickly on the question about the twin deficits, the idea is that, you know, the trade deficit in total adds up the deficit that consumers produce as well as governments produce. So you are absolutely right, these two are closely related. There have been historical episodes when they are not correlated as strongly as we've seen in the last two decades, but certainly the deficit problem in the U.S. is as much a government one as it is a personal credit one. Interestingly, the mirror image of that is also true. The high savings in China. You know, we often talk about how if we improve social insurance and social welfare services in China, the savings rate in China will drop. Well, actually, Chinese consumers have savings rates that are pretty much the same as consumers everywhere else in the world, excluding the United States. You know, it's the corporate sector and the government that's been generating the very high measured savings in China. And I take that to be a reflection of feelings of national insecurity rather than personal income insecurity. Fixing the global imbalance problem through fixing the savings problem in China has to take on the problem of feelings of national risk and insecurity rather than simply income insurance. Underlying dynamics of trade and finance, I'm completely sympathetic. And that's what I was trying to get at when I said what we need to do is get a handle on the movements of the total global financial industry in all its forms, possibly breaking it down. But that's where I think we're trying to get at the understanding of how finance and real side growth are more closely related. Looking at simply debt issues gives us some insight on that, but it won't be the whole story. I agree completely. There are interesting issues here to explore.
Great. If you allow me, I have two comments.
One regarding the differentiation between oil and non-oil GDP. You know, when we talk about the effect or impact of oil and GDP in the GCC countries, I think you cannot escape that, even if you talk about non-oil GDP. As you know, in the non-oil GDP, we account all petrochemicals and oil-related industries. So the effect of oil prices is there. And also, the government services, or the public services, is very large in the non-oil GDP, and it's, you know, it's also the impact of oil prices on the level of government expenditure is very high. So I don't think that the results will change if we use the non-oil GDP. This is only my personal views. The second point regarding the sovereign wealth funds, which regarding the PP sale that happened with KIO in the 80s, I believe what we need also, we need a long-term stable regulations and policies in the hosting countries, in the host countries. You don't want regulations that will change overnight. I'll give you an example now. The Congress will pass a legislation to tax 90% on the executives' bonuses, and this is an overnight decision. And I think you need also to create a stable environment of laws and regulations to make sure that, as you ask the sovereign wealth fund countries to, you know, to come up with a clear policies and objectives, also you need also the host countries to also have a long-term stable policies and regulations. But anyway, this is I hope we can discuss this issue further in coming conferences. On behalf of all the audience, I would like to thank our distinguished speakers and also to welcome them all in Kuwait, and I hope you have a pleasant stay in Kuwait. Thank you very much.